From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Expression in Classic Music. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guest is a scholar of music history, currently in residence at the National Humanities Center. She is Wendy Allenbrook of St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. According to Wendy Allenbrook, the nature of musical expression is the subject of ongoing debate among music historians. Music has been called autonomous, formal, and numerable. By contrast, it's also been characterized as fundamentally affective, referring to the human and the mundane. That is, central to Wendy Allenbrook's forthcoming study of musical expression is the question, is the music of the late 18th century Viennese composers a special moment in music history or a model for other musics? By way of illustrating this issue, the examples in the following Soundings discussion are from the works of Mozart, including The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, The Jupiter Symphony, and the F Major Piano Sonata. Here is Wendy Allenbrook.
Through the 18th century, it seems to me, there was a notion that music was a mirror for the world, that art is, in general, imitative. You hold up a mirror and catch the world in some way. And that seems to change sometime in the late 18th century into the 19th century into a vision of expressing what's inside the poet's soul or the musician's soul, which is personal and private and his own and special, not something in common, not the acts of men caught in a mirror, but your own feelings internally that you tell the world. I'm interested in the mirror. That's the way I like to look at the world, and that's the way I think that 18th century composers looked at the world.
Why is the 18th century important or peculiar, special to you?
Well, I mean, to start with, I love the music. I love the music of Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, and I wanted to study it and think about it. And when I turned to that, I saw that this question of expression and what music expressed, as far as those composers were concerned, was a question which had become obscured for us, because we have this legacy of art as a lamp, as the expression of individual emotions, not as the imitation of things in common.
Well, does this mean, Wendy, that you're not interested, for example, in the biographical details of a composer's life? That may be interesting to you, but it doesn't bear directly on what you're doing with musical expression.
Exactly. No, I don't think that that's of interest to me. I'm not interested in saying, well, look, Mozart's mother died at this point in Paris, and so this sonata clearly reflects that.
Right.
His pain. For one thing, it doesn't, I don't think, generally. There's not a direct correlation between biographical events in Mozart's life and what he wrote.
Is it fair to say, Wendy Allenbrook, that the music historians have come down on one side or the other of this issue? As you look, for example, today in the scholarly journals about music history, do we really have two clearly defined camps?
Well, they show their interest. I'm not sure that they always even know what they're doing, but they tend to talk about this music in one way or another, depending on a kind of instinctive feeling about what it is. And it seems to me that what's happened in Mozart studies through the years is that because it was not particularly fashionable to think about expression, we liked really to think of music as sublime and the highest of the arts because it can express in a wordless way without referring to mundane things like what humans do or are, some kind of secret expression of the heart, that when we didn't like to think about this mirror of the world notion. And therefore, when you read what these musicologists were forced to do as a result is only talk about the facts and figures of tonal architecture, key structures, whether a particular theme is related to another one. And they weren't able to see that there are these expressive gestures or affects.
They become mathematicians after a fact.
Yes, they do, in a sense. They really do. I mean, they talk about the sublime, but they can't talk about it in any particular way as far as the music is concerned. When I first began talking about these things, I talked about them through opera. Now, there, it seems to me, you have a story, and the story is to be illustrated, supported, perhaps changed slightly, et cetera, by the music written to accompany it. But always, I mean, the questions in stories are moral questions. And so it seems to me that for Mozart, these in the Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni, these gestures of social dances and of the hunt and the court, which were class gestures in some way, became also a moral vocabulary. That is, the word noble means noble born, but it also mm-hmm. means to be noble in character. And he begins to use those gestures to show not only the noble class, mm-hmm. but sometimes in surprising ways to identify people who are noble in character in the operas.
And it implies a lot of social relationships between yes. the haves and the have-nots, to oversimplify.
True, but Mozart wasn't political in any easy sense of the word, I don't think. Mm-hmm. He's looking at all of this cosmos, this ordered cosmos, and reflecting it in his music. And sometimes I think in the operas he makes judgments. I think he makes a judgment in the Marriage of Figaro about, by showing us the friendship between the countess and her servant girl, he shows us people reaching out to each other because they recognize each other as noble, and not mm-hmm. in birth, but in character. But on the other hand, he doesn't say that they're friendly, that friendship is formed through evolution. They retain their classes, mm-hmm. but they reach out to each other, and they're capable of doing it, and I think that's the picture he draws in Figaro. And it's, in a sense, a moral picture. Let me give you an example. We were talking about Figaro mm-hmm. and the marriage of the opera, and I was talking about the friendship of the two women, Susanna and the Countess. And there's a wonderful moment. As a matter of fact, it's one of the moments that led me to whatever understanding I have of these things. In the middle of the second act finale, when it's a very complicated plot, and I won't go into it all, but it suffices to say that Susanna, the servant, is trying to help the Countess out of a very tricky situation. The Countess has a husband who has been philandering, and he's got, I think, especially in this opera, a very harsh and arrogant nature. Mm-hmm. She still loves him. And she's circumstantially at this moment in a very difficult position because her young page is hiding in her closet. And the Count is suddenly bearing down on her, and he's hideously jealous as well as unfaithful. She doesn't know what to do, and she's nearly fainting. Susanna manages to maneuver herself into the closet and chase the page out. The Count goes angrily to the door, after ranting to the Countess and telling her she should die because she's immoral, and she's very nervously fluttering around, and he throws open the door. There's silence for a moment. He says, "Susanna," because there Susanna is in the closet and the page isn't. And then what happens at that moment is really truly wonderful. Susanna, the servant, stands there quietly, and in the background the orchestra plays the essence of a minuet. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Just rhythms, nothing mm-hmm, else. Mm-hmm. And Susanna stands there and just loves this moment in which the Count is utterly discomfited and she's triumphed. And even if you didn't know that was a minuet, you're caught by her nobility, her grace, her dignity. But at the same time, there's something political going on. That mm-hmm. is, the minuet was the Count's dance. It's the noble dance, the dance he would have danced, Susanna wouldn't have. And it's been given by Mozart to Susanna at this moment.
Let's listen to this example, and then we can discuss it.
Okay. Thank you. we hear these rhythms, we feel them. They move us directly. And I think that, I mean, it's a common experience to hear music and to start moving your body to it, to want to dance, right? To, and to know how you're meant to dance, the music tells you. I think at this moment you don't get up and dance, but you feel the way, and Susanna as the singer on stage feels the way she should be moving. That is, in a noble, dignified, calm way. She's triumphant, but nobly triumphant.
All right, and this has nothing really to do, you're telling me, with the intentions of the composer.
Well,
I'm asking you this.
Well, I mean, the question of the intentional fallacy, should I say Mozart wanted? I mean, I'm studying the work, and I'm not going to worry about that. I sometimes say Mozart wanted or intended because it's convenient, but it seems to me I'm looking at the work and studying it. And
its effect upon its audience.
Yes.
Okay.
And it seems to me that I can see a kind of vocabulary that the composer had that he could use because his audience knew it.
All right.
Part of the vocabulary is this minuet. I think it moves us directly. And then if I can put the name minuet on it, it simply intensifies our pleasure at knowing what's going on because we see part also the social context in which Mozart's redefining. He's saying the count's not noble at this moment. Susanna is. And she's moving that way.
Are we talking about sort of categories of feeling here that regardless of how it comes out of the mind of the composer, it's going to act that way upon the audience?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
I think that we're talking about, that's why I love this music and find it so successful because there was since the art music, so-called, of Mozart and Haydn, they would have been shocked to hear it talked about that way, but that's the higher music, whatever, imitates the music, it uses the as grist for its imitative mill, the music of simpler music, the daily music that accompanies what men do, and those, what men dance in certain ways because they feel in certain ways. And so there is a kind of typology of emotions here, which Mozart could use to make Susanna appear to us in a certain way, because we'll recognize the minuet as having both natural and social associations.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about the nature of musical expression. My guest is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, Wendy Allenbrook of St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. According to Wendy Allenbrook, cultural historians have described the nature of musical expression in terms of two primary categories, as autonomous, formal, and numerable, but also as affective and imitative of the human and the mundane. Central to Wendy Allenbrook's forthcoming study of the nature of musical expression is the following question. Is classic music a special moment in music history or a model for other musics?
Well, I think next we might listen to an example from Don Giovanni. I've talked a lot about this triple metered minuet and the way that Susanna moves and what it makes us feel. And I wanted to, you asked me about a kind, am I talking about a typology of expression here? And I'd like to say yes, there's a whole sort of treasure house, a storehouse of rhythmic gestures which move us in certain ways. So let's look at another one. Let's look at one in 4/4, that is in duple, double rhythm. And you all know that, we know that when you walk, that's a march, right?
Right.
And in 4/4, it's a very pedestrian gesture to make a pretty bad pun.
Okay.
All right, then I found another march that hasn't really been named by most historians, but it's really terribly important to the music of Mozart and Haydn, and I call it the Exalted March. It's a march where instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, you move on every other beat. You go 1, 2, 1, 2. It's a slower march, and it's the march, it seems to me, of the most passionate of Mozart's opera heroines, the passionate, dignified, fiery, exalted types, like Donna Anna in the Don Giovanni. She moves that way. Now, this music has not only a natural projection, that is, this, I mean, I think if you can think of moving slowly, 1, 2, marching like that, there's a kind of fierceness and pride and exaltation to it. But I think that's a natural association. It moves you directly. Then there's a whole set of historical associations, which happen for various reasons to do with the church. That is, those notes that when I counted one, two, they're half notes. Half notes are called white notes, that is, sometimes. They have no insides, right, as opposed
That's right.
to black notes, which are colored in.
Filled in.
Those slow white note, it's hard, it's a little complicated to explain, but I think I can make it clear. The white notes were often used as subjects against which you'd write other music, that is, counterpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Counterpoint, especially in the late 18th century, was a very learned activity, and it was often thought to be proper mostly in church music. And because of the ancient tradition of Renaissance counterpoint, and which they thought of as vocal music for the church. And so this whole tradition of contrapuntal, long note, duple music belonging in the church is an historical one.
Mm-hmm.
And that adds to the exaltation. That gives you a historical dimension to the exaltation of these heroines. They're singing what's, in a sense, an ecclesiastical meter. Inspiration is, in some way, divine. There's a connection these women have to the divine, these grand heroines, and sometimes heroes, too.
It adds to the feeling that we are supposed to experience.
Yes, exactly.
Let's listen.
We're supposed to be stirred by Donna Anna's heroism, her her enormous dignity, her fierceness, and her pride. And I would like to point out, by the way, that that performance, I think, because the conductor perhaps isn't aware of the fact that it's really meant to be what I call the exalted march. It's much too slow. I mean, I think she has dignity, but the fierceness of her dignity, the great pride, is missing because of the slow tempo.
And the operative word here is affective. Am I on the right track with that?
Yeah. Well, now tell me how you define affective, and then I'll tell you whether
moving
you're right.
The
it's
audience.
A hard word.
Moving
yes.
the audience. Creating yes. in the audience a sort of category of emotion and feeling.
Yes.
All right.
And which in the operas, I think, becomes then a moral response. We admire or don't admire, if that's what a moral response is, as a result of the kinds of rhythms that these characters move and move to and sing.
This is one of the things that accounts for the universality of what we call classical music.
Mm-hmm.
All people in all times and all ages responding in more or less predictable fashions.
Yes, and I feel what my job is, I mean, if you're interested, is to articulate that so that we simply can say it as well as simply being moved by it.
Well, what you're telling me, after a fashion, Wendy, is that music imitates what? Not at the largest, at the highest, the most abstract level, society, but it imitates human behavior, human speech.
Exactly. At least, let me qualify that for the moment. This music does.
Mm-hmm.
One of my intents in making this study is to ask the question a little later, does all music in some way behave as this thing we call classic music, the Viennese classic masters? Does it behave that way? But I'm not ready to give you an answer to that question yet.
Fair enough. Wendy Allenbrook, let's move to yet another example. What are we going to listen to next?
We're going to listen to the finale of Mozart's last symphony, the Jupiter Symphony, so-called number 41 in C major. And I thought it would be a good example to make the bridge from opera, which, as I said before, where the question is easier, what does music express? Because there's something, setting a text, projecting characters. The question is harder in instrumental music, and I wanted to use a comparison of Donna Anna's motions and the music of the Jupiter Symphony to show you that still the same kind of projecting is going on.
And what we're about to hear, as you say, is instrumental. We're not going to have the human voice
That's right.
acting upon
That's
us
right.
in one way or another.
But the gesture of the exalted march is still there, the slow too. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes called alla breve, meaning moving with the breve, which was the white note, the half mm-hmm. note. And then the interest, this is one of the first in history, really, of the great, in the history of the symphony, the first really exalted grand finale, because it wasn't a habit in Mozart and Haydn to write that kind of finale before. Instead, they wrote quick, witty dance finales. Mm-hmm. But this Beethoven then begins to write these same kinds of grand finales. But this is the first, really. Mozart in his last symphony wrote something which is much more worked out, more grand, more exalted, with more dimension to it, which Beethoven later took up, and most of the finales of his nine symphonies are finales in the sense that we use the word now.
Okay, Wendy, let's listen to this. This is the Jupiter Symphony.
Mm-hmm. The finale.
All right.
Well, what you heard was in the beginning that simple, unadorned white note melody, mm-hmm. four notes really only, in this thing I call the exalted march style, this very sublime style that Mozart often affects. And then after a while you get a kind of courtly march fanfare, and at the end of that courtly march fanfare, suddenly you hear the Jupiter, what's often called the Jupiter melody again, the four-note unadorned melody. But then it's in counterpoint. As you remember, I told you before that counterpoint was one of the things that goes along with this exalted march, and the ensemble means venerableness, mm-hmm. the church. In other words, all the things that might make a style exalted and important in the eyes of its listeners.
And this is the way we are supposed to react.
Yes.
To the extent
now,
that a
the
music
historical is historical dimension, obviously, is something I have to articulate to
right.
you. You didn't know it before.
Uh-huh.
But I think that you're being moved by the rhythms, mm-hmm. that the exalted march style, which is a fierce, proud style of walking,
mm-hmm.
that we all, I think, that if you were to do something to that symphony, that's what you'd probably do.
What are we going to listen to next?
Well, we're going to listen to the F major piano sonata. It's K332 for those people out there who keep Mozart Kirkel listings.
All right.
And it's the first movement. It's a wonderful sonata, and why I chose it particularly is because it's a real harlequinade, that is, it's a reflection in its very beginning, of five different of these rhythmic stances, or topics, sometimes I call them topics for musical discourse, that are just strung one after the other.
What is this?
It starts with a minuet.
Okay. Well,
actually, it's in minuet rhythms in 3-4, but it starts as though it were a singer. Just for four short measures, the piano sounds like its upper voice was a soprano singing an aria. Then answering that is four measures of rather pompous, old-fashioned counterpoint, the way we've been talking about it before. And then after a cadence, that is, after that phrase comes to a close, the whole thing turns into a hunting minuet,
mm-hmm.
that is, minuet rhythms with hunting horns and it's very evocative. Hunting horns, I think, always have a sense of nostalgia and of coming from a distance. And you can hear the hunting horns in the piano, and they make a perfect kind of coda or tail end to the long phrase that mm-hmm. starts this piece. Then, so that's four topics right there, the singer, the counterpoint, and the minuet crossed with hunting horns.
All right.
And then suddenly, the motion away from the familiar harmonic place starts. And it starts with some very passionate music that suddenly, and the style switches to what, to a kind of self-conscious imitation of what is called Sturm und Drang, that is the Sturm und Stress, the very fiery kind of passionate, dark, minor music that Mozart often sometimes affects. And this takes you away from F major, the convenient, comfortable place that you'd established, to a new place, a fifth higher. And then the way Mozart tells you you've arrived at that place is to give you a transparent, lovely, regular, placid minuet to nail it in place.
All right, let's listen.
It's interesting to listen to this recording, which because it seems to me it's not a very good performance, again, and the performer would have really been able to benefit had she had some notion of the differentiation. That is, I think she tries to make it a continuous stream of melody, not realizing that there's five different kinds of emotional stances right in front of her that, if she were to distinguish them, would make the piece infinitely more interesting and lively.
But it nevertheless bears out your thesis, Wendy Allen Brook, that, that music is not abstract, that it is affective.
This music.
All right.
I'm going to. I know it's too bad to keep bringing it back to the narrow question, but it's that later question I'm going to try to tackle this year. In fact, is all music in some way like this? Is does romantic music, where the composers, where the theorists, at least many of them, assert that we turn away from the referential and from imitation, and that music isn't properly to do that? It does strike me still that many romantic composers are doing just that. Or what do we say about Renaissance vocal counterpoint? In what way is that an imitation? But I'm not going to answer those questions today.
Wendy Allen Brook is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. She teaches at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. During her fellowship year at the center, Wendy Allen Brook is at work on a forthcoming study entitled Characteristic Styles in Classic Music, a Study in the Theory of Musical Expression. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Musical Expression, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the development of modern fiction. My guests will be Patricia Meyer Spax of Yale University and Paul Hunter of the University of Rochester. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about the nature of musical expression. Wayne's guest is a scholar in residence at the center, Wendy Allen Brook of St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. Is music formal and autonomous, or is it affective and imitative of the human? Music and expression, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.